Protecting what matters on the right choice, AM 1230 KPRL 99.3 FM with Barry Fisher. Advice and information on protecting what matters most in today's world. Brought to you by Adler Belmont Insurance Brokers and their new associate, Heather Bordan, serving the commercial insurance needs of businesses on the Central Coast.
It's Tuesday. It's 12:30. The bear is in the building. It's time for Protecting What Matters. PWM is the broadcast that helps you become better shoppers and buyers of services and products that protect various aspects of your life, health, and property. We also explore our current events, our history, community, institutions, and local treasures that are notable and worth preserving. I'm getting a little feedback here. Our guest today, we have great guests today. From 12:30 to 1 p.m., I have my colleagues, Erica Scott and Jacob Rothman in the Central Coast Value Network. We're going to talk about the clear path to building a business worth keeping or selling, how business owners can prepare for growth and transition, and we're going to talk a little bit about our upcoming workshops, Clear Path Workshops, in June 17th in Atascadero and June 19th in Arroyo Grande. Erica and Jake, welcome back to Protecting What Matters.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Thank you.
Yeah, glad to have you here. And at 1 o'clock, I've got Megan Barth, who's the executive director, executive editor at the California Globe. She has a new article up today on the goofy voting patterns that are happening in Los Angeles County. We're going to talk about voter fraud and counting incompetence in California, the current state of play in the statewide elections. Well, maybe we're 50% on one, then we lost another one, it looks like, in L.A., but Megan will bring us up to date. And then tech theft in Newport Beach, plus regional and national politics. You can call in or text with questions, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. Before we get started, I want to thank Danelle Nichols and Shelley Gill for inviting the bear to speak at the Paso Robles Republican Women's Federated dinner last night at the Bellacera. They needed a rodeo clown. I was on a panel with Stacey Korsgaden, and unfortunately she didn't make the top two, but my heart goes out to her. She really worked hard to get there for the insurance commissioner race, and she talked about what what it was like, and she'll be back on the show in the not too distant future to talk about we have to make a choice between two evils on the insurance commissioner vote. And so she'll come in and fill us in on that. And then Dave Belmont, who's the sponsor of this show with Adler Belmont Group, and he and Stacy talked about the fire insurance issues, and I really appreciate the Paso Robles Paso Robles Republican Women's Federated. From now on, I'm just going to call them PARUF, okay? The PARUFs out there. They were a great group. All right. We're talking this half hour with again, Erica and Jake, my colleagues in the Central Coast Value Network, Erica Scott, and Jake Rothman. As you might have heard on KPRL, we're holding two seminars later this month on the topics of succession, exit planning, and things that you can do to maximize the value of your business prior to sale or passing it on to heirs. Examples, you like your children or key employees. So we're going to talk about that a little bit today, and then we'll give you a preview of what we'll be talking about in these meetings, because you definitely want to make it if you're a business owner in the North or South County here. So Jake, I'm going to give you the first shot. I usually give Erica the first shot. Give us a quick reintroduction of yourself. You've been on the show a number of times, but tell us a little bit about your wealth management firm.
Yeah, my wealth management firm is Rothman Investment Management in Atascadero. And we provide value to our clients in three broad ways. Financial planning that helps create a roadmap for their future, aligning their financial resources with their hopes, dreams, and values. Proactive tax planning that's about minimizing their tax leakage over a lifetime, not just next year or two. And then thoughtful investment management that incorporates the latest findings from academic research.
Mm-hmm. And Erica, tell us about your consultancy.
Hi, my name is Erica Scott, and I have a company called Book a COO. That's a chief operating officer, so operation and administrative services, to really help that business leader to create clarity within their organization. I have a framework called Strategic Plan Now that helps business owners set and achieve goals faster through roles and responsibilities and clarity about where they're headed. I help with facilitation, culture building, and anything to do with operations and efficiency.
All right. And you are making us efficient. I would tell you that. All right. So before we get started, I want to, you know, I want to set the table here. So we're talking about business exit readiness, okay? And really, and we're going to talk about this as well. You know, this is not something you do last minute, okay? You need to have probably at least a five-year horizon, in my opinion, to really start thinking about this. Now, 50% of businesses are currently owned by boomers today, but 58% of business owners have no transition plan whatsoever and lack formal succession plans. And I think one of the things that we've discovered in our individual practices and then working jointly is how business owners, you know, they're really good at working, what is it, in their business, but not on their business. And so this is really important, whether you want to keep your business and make it more profitable, more efficient, or whether you want to bring your kids along and have them succeed you, or whether you just want to sell and get out of Dodge. Okay, you really need to have a plan, and that's what we're trying to help people do today. Again, as my one of my commercials says, 98% of business owners, what is it, 72% of business owners expect to sell their business and make that their retirement funding, but only 2% know what their business is really worth. So again, a huge disconnect out there. So let's start a little bit about where we're going. What is the starting point of all of this? So, you know, Erica, when you go in and talk to people about, you know, okay, we need to get you organized, at least just to be more efficient or be more profitable or whatever, what's the first step that you recommend?
I'll typically do an intake, or like we've created a readiness quiz for the Central Coast Valley Network. And that readiness or that intake really gets a snapshot of where the business owner is, the organization maturity, and what they're hoping to achieve, whether that is to keep and grow the business or to eventually sell it. So really understanding, getting those intake forms and assessment and truly understanding is that first piece. Okay. And then from there, having a true valuation done so that you understand the value and it's not just a guess, that it's really based on inputs. The process that they go through with you on that valuation is tremendously helpful to ensure that we're working off of an accurate set of information.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think business owners are so resistant to this kind of investigation into their own business? Maybe I'm a navel gazer, but I've always been really fairly introspective about my business and trying to always figure out how I can, you know, make the clock tick better, you know, be more on time or whatever it is. I mean, do you find that business owners in general are resistant to this kind of review of what they're doing?
I think it really takes a growth mindset and a strong leader to see and be open to feedback. Mm-hmm. Often looking in the mirror can be hard. And as you said, they're working in the business so much, to come out and take that balcony view can be really challenging. But it's in that balcony view where you can pull in key advisors to help you make those right decisions so you don't have to go down the wrong roads. So that's why this group coming together, we really saw the value in breaking down those walls between what are your personal and business financial goals? How does that play into building that asset, that business? And you have to know the true value and how you're making change over time in that value.
Right. And again, I think there was just an email that came out from the Exit Planning Institute about, and there's a race car video in there, but the headline on this email was driving value starts with measuring performance, right?
Right.
And unless you know where you're starting, where the journey is starting, you really don't know where you're going.
Right. And having a clear plan. So knowing, having the accurate information, you know, I say even with AI, everything, it's junk in, junk out. Mm-hmm. So if you're starting with a bad set of data, then you're not going to be able to really create and change and create that value that you want. So having the right information to create a clear plan that you can execute against will give you more opportunities to create that enterprise value and efficiency, save time, and ultimately increase the value of your business.
Right, because the valuation really gives you a picture of not only what the business is potentially worth to a willing buyer, right, and a willing seller, but it also gives you key performance indicators, right, that stack you up against the competition, and they can be really instructive in improving. Do you have do you have an example of, you know, how, you know, in your work that where KPI has been really instrumental in helping a business owner make a big change, a big decision?
Yeah,
I know that was a question we haven't discussed.
Yeah.
But
so I don't want to divulge client information, but I would say a lot of times what I'll do is look at what the key performance indicators are, and how do we narrow it down besides like revenue? What is one driver that might be the thing that impacts all of these different areas? And so whether that's in a medical practice, doctor days. So how many days is the doctor in the practice able to generate revenue? If you don't hit a number of doctor days and average revenue on those days, then you might not be able to hit that goal. I worked once with a bowling alley, and we did lane utilization. And we realized that impacted all revenue areas.
Right.
And so rather than looking at, you know, everybody has their own key performance indicators, then we looked at that one specific. So once you really understand the business and industry benchmarks, then you see what are some of those unique performance indicators that can really help drive that change.
And then How is this used over time to help profitability? I mean, it's really what you're looking to do is increase your margins, right?
Right. But having clear processes documented, not having over dependence on key employees or having documented processes so that others can do those jobs, or even owner dependence. And those are all factors that come out of that biz equity report and the valuation that then we can incorporate into the assessments that I do and the assessments that Jake does for the finances. And by having all those things come together, we can create a better plan for driving and changing and that value over time.
Okay. And then, Jake, how does this type of information provide your clients with the actionable intelligence they need to be able to start doing their financial planning? Because I find that a lot of business owners, I mean, I did this, you know, everything that all my profit went back in, not all my profit, but a lot of my profit went back in to keep building the business. And at some point, you know, when you get to a certain age, you got to start planning for the future, right?
Right. So for most business owners, their business is both their source of income and their largest asset.
Mm-hmm.
And so for business owners thinking about retiring, and it's always best to think early, there are really two ways that you can do this. One would be start with the desired lifestyle and figure out what it's going to cost. And then you can back solve to here's what I need to sell my business for when taking all of my other financial resources into account. And now we can work toward, okay, so the business needs to grow to a certain level to attain that valuation so that you can achieve this. The other would be I can just, and this is more for someone who's closer to wanting to step out, here's what I've got. What can I do with it? And so then we can work with, okay, what's a realistic, realizable value for your business when you sell it? And then what does that afford you in terms of lifestyle?
So, and talk a little bit about, I mean, we get the question all the time is like, okay, what are the options for selling at some point? You know, you either got somebody's, you know, you got an angel walking in and says, I want to buy your business, or, but there's other methods too, right?
There are several, right? So one common one would be a family succession plan. And that can be great because you get to see your kids doing what you did. Sometimes generation two, generation three can grow a business beyond what the founder was able to achieve or even envision. There's a lot of positives to that. There's some tax efficiency if you plan for that appropriately. The drawback is if the offspring taking over the business have no qualifications other than the right surname, then there could be a lot of value destroyed. You know, the business could be destroyed and the family wealth could be destroyed. So that's something to take into account. But other options, management buyout can be a great one because it rewards the people who help you build your business and care so much about it, and it allows them to become owners. Another would be a financial buyer, so someone else who just wants to have a business like yours.
M&A, basically.
Yeah. Or a strategic buyer, which would be an adjacent type as a competitor or supplier or customer that might buy you at a premium because they see potential for synergies. And you have to be aware, if you're selling to a synergistic buyer, you're probably going to see your people laid off, at least some of them, because that's part of the synergies. And then one other option that's really interesting is employee stock ownership plans.
Yeah, explain ESOPs. I mean, I think that's, I mean, they've been around for a long time, but they're, you know, people don't really know what they are. So dig a little deeper on that.
Yeah, an ESOP is basically like a qualified retirement plan and a management levered buyout rolled into one. And so the beautiful thing is that the owner can control what happens to the company and turn it over to existing employees, and it can be 30%, it can be 100%, you know, whatever makes sense. There's also a Section 1042 tax deferral. So if you do it right and you structure it right, the whole transaction can be done deferring any taxes. Mm-hmm. So instead of paying maybe 25 to 30% in taxes when you sell, you pay zero. And you can defer those for the rest of your life, and then your kids can get a step up in basis, and they don't pay either. There's a lot of boxes that have to be checked, but it is very doable. And then the owner has to be willing, usually, to do seller financing for part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like you just walk away with a pile of money on day
right.
one.
And one of the things that we're doing here, I know that, you know, I think is really important to... Oh, and by the way, I want to go back to something you mentioned. I was going to mention it before.
Yeah.
But I actually... There was a very successful 100-year-old property casualty insurance agency in Denver that I used to work with when I lived in Colorado. Mm-hmm. I lived in Colorado, but I didn't. But I worked with them when I was in California, and it was a family-owned. It was already on the third generation, the grandparents, the father, and what the father did was he actually hired an attorney who created a 5 to 10 year plan for the kids to take over this agency. And one of the rules was that if the kids wanted to come into the agency, they had to work somewhere else for at least 5 years, so that they really didn't have that entitlement sense that so many kids have who think, hey, this is my business, you know, turn it over to me. So
that's a great idea.
That is a great idea. So Erica, talk a little bit about how we're expanding the network, the value network, because, we do what we do, but there's a whole lot of allied professionals and other people who can be helpful in this process. So who are we, without naming names at this point, because we're still waiting for some answers, what types of allied professionals are we bringing into the Central Coast Value Network?
Well, the core of the three of us are really that financial, the risk mitigation and understanding value, and then how do we create that transformation and have a strategic plan to carry it out and have accountability. That's the core three of us. But then we're inviting other people into, say, we say, like the board of directors or the bench of strength for the business owners, knowing that you know, you might have a CPA that you work with, a business attorney, your bookkeeper, these other entities that help support the overall business owner. And so we can invite them into our group so that we can support that business owner holistically. They don't have to know who to go to when, and we're all aware, and it saves them time and energy and effort, so that we're all a coordinated effort. And if they need a recommendation in those areas, we have those partnerships that we've developed.
Well, I know how difficult it is from talking to business owners to find good tax help in this county, and I mean, I only play an attorney on the radio, so it's really hard for me to do a lot of stuff. Folks, you can learn more about the Central Coast Value Network by going to myvaluenetwork.com. Click on view events, and you can see these events and register for them. And if you hold off for a minute after the break, we're going to give you some promo codes that you can use to maybe sweeten the pot. So stand by. Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Erica Scott and Jake Rothman, my two colleagues, two of my three colleagues in the Central Coast Value Network. You can learn more about what we're doing by going to myvaluenetwork.com. You don't have to put the www, right? You just put myvaluenetwork.com and it'll work, right?
Yeah.
You're the maven. You're the maven. I think I tried it. So anyway, and also, by the way, Erica was just told me there are no promo codes because why, Erica?
We are offering a buy one, get one code, or not code, but offer for the first 10 registrants at each of the locations. So we have a date on the 17th in Atascadero and on the 19th in Oro Grande. And the first 10 registrants at either of those is going to get a buy one, get one off. And the tickets are $25, so that means two people for $25, and ticket prices go up at the door. If you are a referring partner and interested in attending, email us at centralcoastvaluenetwork@gmail.com or fill out the referring partner questionnaire at the bottom of that the webpage at myvaluenetwork.com.
Yes, and if you are interested in becoming a referral partner, we'd really love to talk to you. In fact, I talked to a young man today who's been in a he's basically what we used to call a headhunter. Now he calls himself a talent agent for businesses. And he also does counseling, you know, to help people, you know, up their game for getting interviewed for jobs. So he does the fit placement, and he's really very bright young man. We're going to get him on the radio to talk about what he does, and he'll be a great add-on to the Central Coast Value Network. By the way, if anybody has any questions, you can call in at 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. Let's just talk about, we have a few minutes left. You know, let's start with Jake. What common mistakes do you find that people make in their businesses that really hold them back?
I think there's a couple of things. One is buying for a tax deduction that may not necessarily be needed. And then they take the expense in year one, and then after that, any income produced by that asset is fully taxable. There's no depreciation shield left. So sometimes that's a smart strategy, but I think people tend to be too short-sighted in trying to pay zero tax this year without any idea of what the consequences are over the longer term.
And then let me just back up for a minute. So you're really talking about all this, I guess, accelerated depreciation businesses can take when they buy a piece of equipment. It's great until the second year.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah.
So, and sometimes it makes sense to just try to wipe out your taxes for a year, but not always. And I think people don't understand that.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I think is just waiting too long to figure out what to do next. Waiting too long to make a plan so that they're just bogged down in the day-to-day and maybe not focused on the right things to maximize their value or to know when it's time to move on.
Yeah. What about you, Erica? What are your thoughts?
I completely agree with the lack of a plan. Yeah. But it's also communicating and having transparency in that plan. Yeah. So when people don't know what they're responsible for or how they fit into the bigger picture, so it's taking not just taking that plan, but also how do you communicate it and live it out so that you're actually making progress. And that accountability is huge.
Right. I think, and again, I'm not a CPA, but the one thing that I see, the two things that I see that are the biggest problems are, number one, people, you know, especially, you know, they start a business and then again they work in their business and they don't look at the big picture. I'm just flummoxed that people are not using corporations more or LLCs more, pass through entities, that they basically just leave, they stay in their sole proprietorship mode, and it really becomes a problem when you're trying to do a business valuation, because it's hard to identify all that seller's discretionary earnings that goes in, you know, goes into the value of the business, and it's just really hard to flesh that information out of a sole proprietor's situation. And then the other thing, and again, I know it costs $800 a year for the, you know, for the wonderful California Franchise Tax Board, and I know you got to do another tax return, right? But still, again, if you're really trying to spruce up your business, you know, and get the plan there, especially if you're going to pass it on to your kids or whatever, you need to have a good corporate structure. And again, I'm not a CPA, but I just know from the business valuation perspective, it becomes an issue. And then the other thing, again, too, is poor accounting. You know, I mean, it's hard to figure out your valuation if we don't know where the money is coming and going and flowing and doing all that kind of stuff. What kind of tips do you have on those two items, Erica, when it comes to the accounting, setting up a good accounting system, let's say?
I think making sure that you either have somebody on staff or you're hiring those key vendors and people to support you. So it goes back to that cohesive board of directors, so to speak. And sometimes it's not even knowing the opportunity. And that's where the workshops that we're doing mm-hmm. are helping to highlight the importance and how all these things work together mm-hmm. and how we each can, our own expertise, we can bring together these opportunities for business owners that they might not know were available to them.
Right, right. The other thing that I'm finding, of course, is that, again, the succession planning is not in place. I mean, there are so many businesses. What's the statistic here? I've got these in front of me here. 41%. Only 22% of companies have key person insurance. Okay, which, and again, the owner is a key person.
Right.
I'm doing about two or three of these right now. It's like you got to have some key person, because if something happens to the owner, who's the major domo in most cases in the company, there's going to be a loss to that company. And a lot of times it's a family business. They also, most don't have a proper, what's called a buy sell agreement or a succession agreement that's funded with life insurance to be right. able to, because again, like as I've mentioned on many shows, you know, if you've got two business owners or more, if one of them dies, you don't want to be partners with the heirs of the deceased.
Right.
And you also, by the way, need a business valuation because first of all, the insurance companies now always ask, how did you come up with this value in your buy-sell agreement? And at least, you know, if you say, I did a business valuation, you're good. And then, of course, you need to have the right kind of succession planning documents. There's different types of buy-sell agreements and different ways to fund it and set them up and all those types of things. I know these are very mundane things nobody wants to talk about.
Right. It's that clarity that'll get you where you want to go.
Clarity is a rarity. So come to one of our seminars. Jake and Erica, thanks so much for taking the time to come in and talking to the listeners. And hopefully we'll see some of them at our meetings later this month. All right. Go to the Central Coast Value, mycentralcoastvaluenetwork.com. And we'll be back on the other side of the break with Megan Barth of the California Globe.
Join us next Tuesday for Protect What Matters the Most with Barry Fisher. Send your questions and show topic ideas to barry@blazinbear.com.
Protecting what matters on The Right Choice, AM 1230, KPRL, 99.3 FM with Barry Fisher. Advice and information on protecting what matters most in today's world. Brought to you by Adler Belmont Insurance Brokers and their new associate, Heather Bordan, serving the commercial insurance needs of businesses on the Central Coast.
Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. PWM is the broadcast that helps you become better shoppers and buyers of services and products to protect various aspects of your life, health, and property. We also explore current events, history, our community, institutions, and local treasures that are notable and worth preserving. This hour's guest is Megan Barth. She's the executive director of executive editor of the California Globe. We're going to talk about the latest on voter fraud and counting incompetence in California, the current state of play in statewide elections. Unfortunately, we may have won one, but we may have lost another. Megan's going to give us the latest update, and tech theft in Newport Beach, another interesting story that Megan has covered, in all kinds of other national politics and news. Megan, welcome back to Protecting What Matters.
Hi, Barry. Thanks so much for having me back.
It's great having you. Folks, you can call in and with questions or comments, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. So, Megan, I realized after you were on for the half-hour segment about a month or so ago, I realized that I probably rushed you through way too much content, which is why I'm so happy that you could spend a whole hour with us today. Just take a minute or two giving our listeners again a bit of your background, because you've really been doing journalism and reporting and political reporting in particular for quite some time.
Yeah, when I add up the years, I always surprise myself. But I've been in the political game since about 2008. Prior to that, I was in the medical business, specifically vaccines and biotherapeutics, for about 20 years. So Obamacare really got me off my couch. I, of course, was fighting against it. I was working with a large medical device manufacturers and pharmaceutical manufacturers, and they were against it, and it was going to hurt my clients as well as hurt the country. And yes, I was right. But then after I cut my teeth in that career, I'd always loved to write. I'm an English major, and so I picked up a pen and started writing, and my writing was picked up nationally. And then I also started doing reporting on local and national politics, worked undercover as an investigative reporter during COVID, during the election, the 2020 election, and prior to that, saw a lot of things that you can't unsee. And so I've been really an election hawk for quite some time, because I did live in California from 1996 to 2015 in Southern California, and then I became a California refugee in June of 2015 and thought I was moving to a bright red state called Nevada, and boy, was I wrong. So I started uncovering a lot of anomalies within our voter rolls. And unfortunately, in 2016 and 18, the Democrats seized control of the legislature. They seized control of the governorship in Nevada, and they changed all of our voting laws. They really modeled Nevada's voting laws after California's voting laws during the pandemic. So what we saw, not only in California, but also Nevada and across the nation, was that safeguards were absolutely eliminated in the election process and in election law, and it was replaced by mail-in balloting, for example. So I often say, Barry, that what used to be illegal has now been made legal by the law. So Democrats drafted and passed laws that made illegal activities related to voting now legal. And one good example of that is ballot harvesting, mail-in balloting, reduced voter ID or no voter ID at all in order to vote. And what we're told continuously by Democrats is that all of these changes were somehow going to increase participation. Well, as a matter of fact, that hasn't happened. Voting participation has not increased. But what has increased is the amount of time it takes now Democrats to count the votes. And it also has increased Democratic representation after Election Day, because wouldn't you know it, Democrats always win an election after Election Day. And we saw this very clearly in the 2024 election. When a handful, I think it was like five or six Democrats, took congressional seats from leading Republicans throughout California. So always when you see the late mail-in ballots come in, or the ballots that were dropped off in drop boxes and ballot harvested, 90% of the time, the Democrats win, because it seems like all the Democrat ballots are held until the end to be counted, or the statistical anomaly presents itself that says, geez, out of 100,000 ballots, how did Spencer Pratt get two votes?
Yeah.
You know? So there's stuff like that. And so all of this manipulation of election laws, specifically done by Democrats and Mark Elias, for example, the lawyer, all these changes to election laws has not increased voter participation. It's actually fueled voter speculation, and it has fueled a lack of confidence in our elections.
Yeah, you know, I was going through all your articles and reading some other stuff, and I, you know, it occurred to me that really with all of these Democrat changes in the voting system over the last 20 years or so, that we're really seeing the features of the system, not the bugs. These are built-in features to give them control of the vote, correct?
Correct. That's a very simple way of saying it.
Yeah. I mean, what did Stalin said back in the 1920s, it doesn't make any difference who votes and who counts the votes.
Correct. And that's exactly what I said on the John Cobalt radio show last week. And I, you know, he asked me if I thought Spencer Pratt would pull it out. And I said, look, the system has been designed against him. It doesn't matter who counts the votes, it doesn't matter who votes, it matters who counts the votes. And he had a little chuckle, but it's exactly right. When you eliminate safeguards from a process, I mean, I used to be in medical manufacturing engineering, okay? That was my background for 23 years. You know, I was in the manufacturing side. And so whenever we had a process, I usually compare it to this. When you have a process, if you change that process, then you must revalidate the process to ensure that you are still getting a 99.9% return rate, right? That's never happened. We've never tested all of these changes. We've never validated all of these changes. They just say, well, there's no widespread fraud. Well, how do you know? Democrats used to say, voter fraud is a myth. Do you remember that?
They used to,
I had people tell me that all the time. Democrats, oh, voter fraud is a myth. Well, then all of a sudden the narrative changed to, well, there's not enough fraud to affect the outcome. It's not widespread. You know, the voter fraud isn't widespread. Well, how did it go from it's a myth to not widespread in just a matter of months?
Yeah. It's really quite discouraging. I was on a panel yesterday with Stacey Korsgaden, who was one of the candidates for insurance commissioner. And, you know, unfortunately, I think she came in third, and she's actually an insurance agent by training, and would have been one of the first people to ever be an insurance commissioner in California who knew about insurance, anything about insurance. And you know the kind of fire insurance issues we're having here, and I think you are as well in Nevada. But, I mean, it's just discouraging that she, you know, spent a lot of money and time, and I'm not sure she actually got a fair shake from the process.
Well, and I think the process not only does discourage good people to run for office, you know, and I don't know Stacey, but judging from what you said, it may discourage her from trying to run again because the system has been designed really against a first-time candidate, right? And it's really tailored to the system is specifically designed to protect the status quo.
And all of this, I mean, all of this just, I think, magnifies the problems in the jungle primary system that, again, the Democrats pushed on us. And the fact that, you know, you really, in my perception, and you know, the state Republican Party, the California Republican Party, is basically a non-player. So there's, you know, on the Republican side here in California, it seems to become a circular firing squad on the Republican side in many of these races.
Well, and if you look at ballot harvesting, for example, that the Democrats unilaterally passed in Nevada, and I think the same perhaps was done in California, I think 10 years ago, you know, ballot harvesting used to be whereby, you know, you were in a nursing home and you had your granddaughter be notarized to pick up your ballot and deliver it.
Right.
And that's when we, you know, that's when we had in-person voting and perhaps early voting at the time. Now, even that notary step has been completely removed. And so Democrats were smart enough and cunning enough to pass universal mail balloting along with universal ballot harvesting. And the universal ballot harvesting, they already have the infrastructure worked into their party. They have the unions. They have the NGOs that will use their resources to mass harvest ballots. The Republican Party simply did not have that until really recently with the genesis of Turning Point USA. you know, we have Turning Point USA playing in Nevada. They just opened an office down in Clark County where Las Vegas is. But they're also working on behalf of a outsider candidate in northern Nevada against a longtime legislature and rancher. And so they have that infrastructure just for that one specific race and races down in Clark County. But it does not match the power of the ballot harvesting infrastructure that the Democrats have in their back pocket.
Yep. So in the last week, you've written some really great articles on the Globe, and I hope everybody goes back and looks at these. But I'm going to let you kind of summarize them and wrap the various themes. But there was one regarding the massive number of, 900,000 or so ballots that are out there that are getting mailed out to people that don't exist here in California anymore. Basically, California's election system has become third world. And now you've got, the DOJ, the Justice Department, U.S. Justice Department, investigating all this. So how does all this fit in together, and what do you expect to have happen? What do you expect anything from the DOJ investigations and on any of this?
Yeah, so let me just kind of take you over just a few of the one specifically, the ghost voters, and that's what
yeah.
we call ghost voters.
Right.
And Judicial Watch is now suing Shirley Weber and the state of California, SOS Shirley Weber and the state of California, because they found through their own investigation that there are 873,000 ghost voters on the California voter rolls. Now, what do I mean by ghost voters? Well, these are voters who have been inactive for at least two or three consecutive federal elections. That's roughly, 6 years? There are another 151,000 that have been inactive for 8 years. There's another 35,000 or so that have been active for five or more years. So you have an enormous amount of inactivated voters to the tune of over 800,000, nearly 900,000, quite frankly, on California's voter rolls. Now, all of these people should have been removed years ago, and they have never been removed, which is a huge red flag that the DOJ and anybody with an IQ of more than, 90 can understand that when you have inactive voters on a universal mail-in ballot list, those inactive voters are going to get ballots when they should not get ballots. Those voters should have been removed according not just to state law, but to federal law. And that's the Help America Vote Act. So you have Don Wagner, who's running for Secretary of State, who lost. He is the plaintiff in that case. The case is represented by Judicial Watch. And so, 870,000+ names should have been removed, should not have gotten ballots for this primary election or even past elections, because some of these voters have been on the rolls since 2016 now or prior. In response to this, and added to this, is the DOJ. And the DOJ said, hey, we want to audit your voter rolls. We want to ensure that there are no dead voters, that there are no inactive voters, that there are no non-citizens on the voter rolls. We want to audit. And California, along with Nevada, said, no, go pound sand. And the reason they said that, according to them, is that there is protected voter data, and it would be a breach of the voters' privacy if they would share something like a Social Security number with the DOJ. Well, excuse me, Barry, but the federal government assigned you the Social Security number.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no privacy breach. The entity that wants and has legal authority to audit the rolls already has, quote-unquote, protected voter data information, because the entity known as the federal government prescribed that number to the voter. So it doesn't really, the defense by Democrats doesn't hold water, and quite frankly doesn't pass the smell test.
Yep.
So we have
a caller. Thanks for calling Protecting What Matters. What's your comment or question for Megan?
Hi, Megan. I'm involved with a local government watchdog group, and we have a weekly newsletter. I include your articles probably three or four times a month, so we really enjoy your writing and the Globes. But my question for you is that, you know, any time people start pointing out all these problems that exist with the voter rolls, with the system, they start talking about the potential for fraud, they're kind of written off as kooks. And before we can really hope to get any change, I think we're going to have to change that public perception. And I don't know how we go about doing that. Just wondering what you think about how to get the people engaged with this issue.
And what watchdog group are you with, if I can ask? I'll subscribe to the letter.
it's called CoLab. It's a Coalition of Labor, Agriculture, and Business.
And Katie was the speaker at the last annual dinner. So, hi, Greg.
Yes, of course. Yes.
Hi, Barry.
Yeah. That's fantastic. I've heard great things about your group, and thank you for the question. You know, I believe people understand numbers, okay, and data doesn't lie, politicians do. I always say that. So when you have 873,000 voters that should not be on the voter roll, that gets someone's attention. These numbers aren't, and I'm always very wary to say there's voter fraud, right? Well, because the fraud's already been baked into the statute, right? So you can't necessarily remove the claims of fraud unless you remove the statute. So the numbers are very important. I also think that this primary election, specifically in LA City Council, and then add to that the gubernatorial election, has really exposed kind of the wild west of elections in California. I think you have many, many people that, for example, Ro Khanna today, and I'll be writing about this, Ro Khanna tweeted out that many of his Democratic friends voted for Spencer Pratt and are now dropping or changing their registration altogether because they are so disenchanted with what they witnessed in the LA City Council.
Wow. Hey, I hear the bumper music. Megan, I'm going to put you on hold. And Greg, thanks for calling. We'll talk soon.
Sure, thank you.
Folks, we'll be right back with Megan and want to get the latest on her thoughts on the mayor's race in Los Angeles and the governor's race. So stand by. Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Megan Barth, Executive Director of the California Globe. Please call in with questions or comments, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. So, Megan, let's do a quick rundown of where the governor's race here in California stands. I mean, it looks like Hilton is hanging on to the number two spot. I bet there's going to probably be another vote dump today. What's expected here?
Well, and this adds to the absurdity. And what I mean by that is that we were told that it could take a month to count the election. You guys count the ballots up to a month after Election Day. So I think it's like July 6th, right, where you have the time to cure and tabulate the ballots. Well, why are we already making all of these announcements? I don't understand. If every vote must be counted, then why aren't we waiting until every vote is counted? We can give a running total, that's fine, but we're already calling races, which I don't really agree with, nor do I understand. With that said, President Trump went on Truth Social the other day and thinks that Steve Hilton might have a chance of losing the second spot based to all the chicanery that happened in L.A. County and elsewhere. You know, Spencer Pratt was doing extraordinarily well, yet they called the race against him because Nithya Raman, the socialist council member, you know, she's getting 60-70% of the late ballots. And so this is the same thing. Who says that the same thing can't happen to Steve Hilton? So right now it looks that Javier Becerra is in first. Steve Hilton is holding on narrowly to second, and Tom Steyer may make late gains, but he's closing in to Hilton's second place. And if he surpasses Hilton, then once again you'll have two Democrats at the top of the ticket based on the jungle primary.
Yeah. And really, it looks like, I mean, is Spencer Pratt going to do anything to contest this vote count in Los Angeles, or is it too early to tell?
I think it's too early to tell. You know, from what I've read on his social media, where he's very active on Twitter, or X now, you know, he just basically said it's not over till it's over, and truly it's not over until the first week of July.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess we're just going to have to hang on and see what how this all develops. One last quick question on what happened in California, and I want to move on to some national politics. There was an article yesterday, I believe, in the Real Clear Politics website that Newsom's Prop 50 gerrymander may not have worked out as well as he had hoped. Have you been tracking on that and see what happened in those congressional districts?
A little bit, and I wrote about this, actually, and I'll just grab it really quick. It was about Adam Gray, and the district is at 31. It's not in front of me, and forgive me, or is it 13? But it's Adam Gray's district. I'll pull that up really quick.
Yeah.
Based on how California's, specifically Republican districts, were sliced and diced like a Thanksgiving turkey, and brought in, you know, a huge, significant Democratic advantages. We're talking, and the same thing happened to Nevada, okay? But the, you know, for example, in Adam Gray's district, which was always against Duarte, right? They went back and forth. It was hundreds of votes, and they were going back and forth. Well, that was gerrymandered by Prop 50 from a +5 Republican advantage to a +5 Democratic, or a .5 Democratic advantage. Well, you know, Adam Gray and others, they should be outperforming what the polls and what the vote counts are because of that gerrymandering, and they simply aren't getting the percentages that you would expect from Prop 50.
Okay, well, that'll be interesting to see. I also heard that Kevin Kiley is hanging in there. He became an independent to run again for Congress, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So, okay. So I guess we're just going to have to see when these votes all come in. Let's shift to national politics. It's hard to avert your eyes from what's going on the national level. In Rules for Radicals, Saul Alinsky urged his radicals to accuse opponents of what they're known to do. Anybody who's not a progressive, I guess that probably includes you and I, are Nazis or fascists. What do you make of this whole Graham Plattner race in Maine? It seems to me this is emblematic of the Democrat Party.
Well, it certainly tells you a lot when Ro Khanna flies out to Maine to do a fundraiser, rah-rah rally, for a dude who is accused of multiple extramarital affairs. We don't know if any of them were underage, but he was using Kik, which is a platform that oftentimes men of less desirable reputations use, let's just put it that way. He has a Nazi tattoo on his chest. He has made pro-communist, pro-socialist statements, anti-American statements on Reddit, and the list goes on and on. And what Ro Khanna tells us, is, along with other prominent Democrats, is that you must elect the abuser, Nazi tattoo-sporting, communist, anti-American dude in order to protect Democrats' power or to strip power from the Republican Senate. So the Democrats are totally fine with Nazis in Congress. It just has to be their Nazis.
God. I'm sorry I'm laughing. I mean, it's just incredible.
It's absurd. It's the theater of the absurd. But it also reveals who the Democrat Party is. I've always said they're never moored in principle. They are moored in power. Because they don't say rest in peace when someone passes. No, they say rest in power. So they are all about power. It's not about principles. It was never about, they knew we weren't Nazis. They knew it.
Right.
They knew we weren't, you know, racists. But using supercharged emotional language to demonize your opponent is a typical tactic, especially in politics. But along that, I have to add, the Southern Poverty Law Center was actually paying actual Nazis to go and create mayhem and protest around the country.
Yep.
But yet, like I said, the Democrats are willing to elect a Nazi as long as it's their Nazi. And that's only to protect their power.
So I mean, you know, for forever, really, we've viewed the United States as a center right country, basically, you know, fairly conservative still in the main. But when you look at the national political picture, because of everybody moving to different states, you know, where they think they're going to be more welcome politically and more welcome from a business perspective or whatever it is, everything's really getting totally polarized, isn't it, from state to state?
Well, and purposefully so, because our elections have gotten so polarized through the demonization of your political opponent. You know, no longer are we having these robust debates on the battle of ideas, not even at the local level. It's very hard to find local-level debate,
mm-hmm.
Where, you know, voters can then decide, you know, which person running for Congress or which person running for Assembly or State Senate has better ideas, that they align. It's more just the politics of personal destruction,
mm-hmm.
which has been going on for as long as I've been paying attention to politics. However, it is really, it's now become violent.
Mm-hmm.
And the political violence is not only being tolerated to some extent, it is being encouraged and it's being celebrated. And we can see this specifically. And it's not that, you know, Republicans are storming softball fields trying to murder a bunch of Democratic congressmen just wanting to play baseball. It's not Republicans who are going onto college campuses and assassinating leading Democratic voices like they did with Charlie Kirk. It's not Republicans celebrating the death of a Democrat, whether that be Ruth Bader Ginsburg or whoever. It is specifically Democrats, and yet they want to tell us somehow calling Republicans Nazis for the last 2, 3, 4 election cycles has somehow toned down the violence. You know, their rhetoric directly contributes to political violence. And what we have are dark money groups, to use the Democratic terms, the lingo, dark money groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center, like the NGOs, like Antifa, those who gathered around Brett Kavanaugh's home and sent death threats to Justice Kavanaugh before he was confirmed. These are specific violent tactics of the left. And it's not that the left has changed. It's that the left has been hijacked by the very radicals it once rejected.
Yep. You know who really does surprise me, you mentioned his name, Congressman Ro Khanna, who's, you know, up in Silicon Valley. I mean, it seemed to me he was trying to position himself, A, as a moderate in the party, and B, I mean, I think he was even thinking of running for president, you know, or getting involved in, you know, bigger things for himself. He seems to have taken the Kool-Aid, you know, on this Graham Platner thing.
Well, most leading Democrats have drunk, as far as from a position of leadership or power within the Democratic apparatus, most leading Democrats, whether that's Hakeem Jeffries or others, are rallying behind Graham Plantner because supposedly Susan Collins just isn't radical enough. They say she's too moderate or she votes with Trump too many times. So therefore, they need a Nazi to straighten everything out.
Yeah. Yeah, hopefully Susan Collins can hang on. Let me ask you another question. What do you make of the Trump endorsement near sweep in the primaries? Do you think that has any significance, or do you think it's a good thing or a bad thing that the Republicans may not have a more moderate, bench out there that's running in the general election on the congressional side than the Senate side?
Well, my question is, what is moderate in today's terms?
Yeah.
I mean, we seem to have pro-Americans and anti-Americans. So, you know, what's in the middle of that?
Right.
Kind of American? I don't know what a moderate means anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think that Trump, you know, he's obviously just knocking him out of the park, right? He's, you know, 37 for 37. Mm-hmm. However, in northern Nevada, which you're just a few hours away from, there is a big congressional race here where the incumbent resigned early, Congressman Mark Amaday, from Congressional District 2, which covers half the state of Nevada. It's the largest, I think, congressional district in the country.
Mm-hmm.
It's half the state of Nevada, and President Trump endorsed somebody that northern Nevadans didn't even know. His name is Dave Filippo, and Mark Amaday endorsed James Settlemyer. Now, why is this important? James Settlemyer is a fourth-generation rancher in northern Nevada. He was a former Nevada lawmaker, Republican. Dave Filippo lives in Las Vegas. He doesn't even live in the county. He's renting a house up here. And President Trump was supposed to not endorse, and he endorsed. And I'll tell you, that endorsement shook the entire district. No one expected it at all. And I've talked to hundreds of people. And so that's a race to watch to see if President Trump's endorsement holds, because it's going to be, I think, a very tight race up here between a fourth generation rancher who knows the land better than and the topography better than anybody else on any ticket, compared to what they call a carpetbagger from Las Vegas, but President Trump endorsed.
So how, did Trump have a reason for doing this, or did he just, what's the backstory here? Did Amadeo, or whatever, I think I got the name right, did he not do something that Trump didn't, did he do something that Trump was not happy with?
Yeah, there's a couple rumors. So the one rumor is that Trump was no fan of Congressman Amaday because of some of Amaday's votes. I guess you could call Amaday more of a moderate. But then you have Filippo, who was endorsed by everybody outside the state of Nevada that, you know, of prominence. You know, Paul Gosar out of Arizona, Sheriff Arpaio out of Arizona, Turning Point out of Arizona. And with President Trump's alignment with some of the MAGA-aligned officials or candidates, especially TPUSA as well, that perhaps influenced his vote. So it's not really clear, but I think probably a combination of those two reasons, his dislike for Amaday on certain issues and his allegiance or at least closeness with TPUSA and others may have influenced President Trump's endorsement.
I see. So any other races we should be watching? Because the primary is today, right, in Nevada?
Yeah, it's today, and I'm sorry to report that I never received my mail-in ballot. Yes, of all the people for them to mess up on, probably shouldn't have been me. I even gave them a second chance, and they said, well, would you like us to deactivate this ballot and send you another ballot? I said, sure, let's try it again. Didn't receive the second ballot.
Yeah.
So I drove up to what would normally be my precinct. Remember when we had precinct voting and we always had results on election night. Remember, mm-hmm. It wasn't too long ago.
Yep.
It worked like a charm, even before the advent of the internet. It was amazing how that worked. But Democrats had to change it. So I am going to go vote in person, and I did see some long lines at a pretty rural voting location. So I'm going to, after we hang up here, I'm going to scoot over and see if I can cast my ballot in person. And I think the races, this CD2 race, Northern Nevada race, I think is one to watch because of Trump's endorsement to see if he holds on. I also think that the gubernatorial race in Nevada is extraordinarily important. We have a lot of visitors from California, and we have a lot of new residents that have moved here from California. And the good news is that more Republicans are moving from California into Nevada than are Democrats. So I'm very happy about that. We welcome the Republicans with open arms. We don't want our state changed. And we don't certainly want to mimic California any more than the Democratic legislators here choose to do.
Mm-hmm.
But Governor Lombardo is our stop. Like, he is our protection against California policies. Well, so that gubernatorial race is very important as well.
So he's up for re-election, right?
Yeah, he'll be likely running against Aaron Ford, who's our attorney general, who believes that voter ID is unconstitutional.
Ah, okay. Yeah, you've covered that story.
Legal chops.
Yeah, you've covered that story. So yeah, Nevada's on the brink here.
We are.
A couple more questions here. Do you think, I think a big story is all this Medicaid and Medicare fraud and all the investigations. I mean, do you see this as having any impact on the elections? You were involved in the medical care industry for many years. I mean, you were right when you said a lot of the chickens are coming home to roost on what was happening back in the early 2000s with health care in the United States. Do you see this having much impact on the elections?
Yeah, I think, like I said to Greg from CoLab, you know, people see these numbers and it doesn't leave them.
Right.
It basically tattoos their brain. They don't forget that nearly 900,000 people shouldn't be on the voter rolls. They don't forget that Medicaid fraud, you know, in California is, you know, could be $100 billion. So it's all of this bubbling to the top that has been buried under layers and layers of bureaucracy or complicity that is now starting to come to the top. Mm-hmm. And I think these headlines related to the massive amounts of fraud, which, Barry, I'll just add here. So we have Medicaid fraud, homelessness fraud, SNAP fraud, healthcare fraud, hospice fraud, DMV fraud, ghost student fraud, meaning we have ghost students, but we definitely don't have voter fraud.
Right, right.
I mean, that's what we're supposed to believe. But when these numbers start coming in to the tune of billions and billions, and I would say trillions of dollars, people don't forget that, because we're already, because of the pandemic and because of the war in Iran and the conflict in Iran, our dollar is going so much further left. So people are trying to hold on to more. And
right.
Some of us work two jobs.
Yep.
So when they see they're getting ripped off, the biggest motivator outside of fear to get to the polls is anger.
There you go.
Whoever can capture that will win.
All right. I'm going to put you on hold one last time, Megan. So stand by. And folks, when we get back, we'll be talking to Megan about a couple more stories that I find fascinating and that she's been covering as well. So stand by. Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Megan Barth, executive editor of the California Globe. You can call in or text with questions, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. Next week's show is going to feature Eric Olson of the Central Coast Distillery in Atascadero. This is one of my new favorite places, and it's really an unusual place, and he's got a lot of great events and things going on there, and I want to introduce him to the listeners because he's terrific. And then two people you all know very well, Jenny Griniger and Rebecca Kosnick, both school board members on the Templeton and the Atascadero school boards, and we're going to be talking about the SPLC, the Southern Poverty Law Center, and the problems that they've been causing organizations like Moms for Liberty and other things, boys and girls sports, and all the things that we talk about when they come on. One last quick thing, RP Slow is having a barbecue on June 28th in Templeton Park for the 250th year anniversary as a country. And Eric Gorham's going to be barbecuing. So buy tickets. Go to the RP Slow website and buy tickets. Okay, there are two stories I got to get your take on, Megan, before we go. We got about 5 minutes left. And I'm just going to throw them out to you so you can take them in this order. California has passed AB, the California Assembly has passed AB 2624, which is euphemistically referred to as the Stop Nick Shirley Act. He's, of course, the undercover reporter that exposed a lot of this fraud. And then you covered a very interesting story about an Iranian guy down in Newport Beach who was trafficking high-tech stuff to Iran. So I'm interested in your opinion after I just found out you did undercover work as a reporter. I'm interested in your opinion on the Nick Shirley Act, and then tell us a little bit about this story in Newport Beach.
No problem. So yes, I worked undercover for quite some time, and it's amazing what people will tell you when you don't think that you're listening to them or recording them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Nick Shirley has exposed a lot, and undercover reporting, it's the original reporting, it's gumshoe reporting. It's doing the work that not many people like to do, but it uncovers the fraud that you're really looking for, or the facts, really, that you're looking for that have been buried. And so for the Democrats to take it upon themselves, specifically the wife of, is it Bonta, the Attorney General,
mm-hmm.
to draft this legislation, AB 2624, and get it passed is chilling to me, quite frankly, because what you're doing is you are limiting the access to the press, as California Democrats have consistently and chronically done for decades. I mean, if you remember, Katie Grimes was not allowed into the legislature because Jerry Brown didn't like her, and she had a them, and she won. And so California Democrats like to operate in the dark because they don't want the exposure.
Mm-hmm.
And so for this bill is chilling, and you know, we'll see what happens to it, with because I'm sure there will be a lawsuit.
Are media outlets doing anything to lobby against it up there in Sacramento?
I personally have not seen that, but I think the few media outlets that I have seen are concerned, but I haven't seen any lobbying per se.
Okay.
But again, you have the media. The mainstream media does not necessarily do investigative reporting. We're seeing a little bit from CBS now under Barry Weiss. We're seeing a little bit of investigative reporting under Barry Weiss. But in general, the mainstream media just takes whatever the Democrat says and republishes it and never challenges it. With the Iranian dual national, so this guy was living in a $35 million mansion in Newport Coast, which is adjacent to Newport Beach, in Southern California, and he was basically selling tech equipment and military equipment, supplying technology, rather, to Iran's nuclear and military programs. He referred to Iran as his motherland, right, his homeland. So he certainly wasn't America first, but he referred to Iran and the IGRC as his motherland. Now, he's accused of smuggling technology to the regime in Iran and making, obviously, tens of millions of dollars to do that. So he is under investigation. However, he does have a current charge against him that could end him up in prison should he be found guilty for about 20 years.
So this kind of goes hand in hand with some of these other quote unquote espionage or spy stories of people, you know, the Chinese students or professors that are smuggling in, you know, altered bugs, you know, to ruin crops and all that kind of stuff. I mean, is it evidence that the FBI is doing its job now more than it was doing before Trump came back into office?
I think without a doubt, because, you know, you have multiple units within the FBI and some that look specifically at, you know, financial crimes, children's crimes, you know, things like that. And so you have various branches of the FBI that are making significant bucks, whether it's just like espionage, fraud, trafficking, human trafficking bucks. So definitely you have to wonder what the hell the FBI was doing for the years prior.
Yeah, no kidding. Megan, thank you so much for spending this much time with us today. And how is the best way for people to follow you?
CaliforniaGlobe.com.
All right. You have a great rest of the week, and I'm looking forward to seeing what you're covering next. So thank you so much.
Very good,
Gary.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Folks, I'll be back next week with another interesting and fun group of guests. So have a great week and enjoy yourselves.
Join us next Tuesday for Protect What Matters the Most with Barry Fisher. Send your questions and show topic ideas to Barry at BlazinBear.com.